little man. Don't let them tell you that they have the plan.
Welcome to Thinking Clearly. This is a show about critical thinking and related topics, and my name is Bob Frelick, here with the other host of Thinking Clearly, Julia Minton. Hey, Julia.
Hi, Bob.
Well, Julia, we've got a great guest with a very interesting topic all connected up with us. We are a show about critical thinking, but as we've discussed many times on Thinking Clearly, even though we think we're doing critical thinking, we can be led astray by our cognitive biases like confirmation bias and by our emotional attachments to the groups with which we identify. So it really becomes crucial for critical thinkers to understand topics such as the nature of political polarization and the cognitive distortions that might overlay our thinking and beliefs by framing the world as us versus them. If we're so polarized that we're not talking to a large fraction of people who believe differently from us, it really disempowers critical thinking. So, Julia, with that introduction, tell folks a little bit about what we're up to on this episode of Thinking Clearly.
Yeah, well, today's topic is going to be focusing on the work done by the nonprofit More in Common. We'll take a closer look at the nature of political tribalism in the U.S., discuss research about the accuracy with which opposing partisan groups perceive each other, and explore some options for ways to draw polarized people together to create environments that foster cooperation and working on shared challenges.
And with a graduate degree in public policy from Harvard Kennedy School of Government, our guest, Stephen Hawkins, directs the research conducted at More in Common, which is a nonprofit organization with teams in the U.S., the U.K., France, and Germany. And More in Common does research focused on understanding the forces which drive people apart and then works to help find common ground to foster cooperation for working on shared challenges. And prior to this work, Stephen advised partners and clients on five continents, including work with the United Nations agencies, political candidates, and Fortune 100 companies such as Ford and Microsoft. Stephen Hawkins, welcome to Thinking Clearly.
Thank you so much, Bob. It's a pleasure to be here. Appreciate the invitation.
And I want to remind listeners that we are pre-recording this interview, so there will be no listener call-ins for this edition of Thinking Clearly.
Stephen, can you give us an overview of the work done by More in Common, and the problems that it's trying to address, and what led you to get involved with that organization?
Sure. So More in Common is about as old as your show. We started in 2016, and we're concerned about division in societies, especially political division. And we believe that having strong, healthy societies that are resilient to the forces of polarization and division allows us to work together more effectively to solve the challenging problems of our time and the challenging problems that will be coming up in the near future. And so what we do is primarily research-driven work, and we study public opinion and especially the psychology of public opinion. We work a lot with academics who have backgrounds in political science and social psychology to help us to understand what some of the phenomena are that are most characterizing our societies and our division today. And then we publish reports and give guidance to big institutional actors like governments, philanthropy, and activist sectors who are trying to speak to the public to try and help them see how they can build larger coalitions, how they can find consensus in moments of division, and how they can understand the populations that they work for, that they serve, and their psychology, so they can speak to them in a way that resonates and that feels sincere and that is effective. So we've now completed about 50 projects over our last 6 years. And in addition to the countries that you read off, Julia, we also are now beginning some work in Italy and Poland and Spain.
I know why I find this interesting. What drew you to this kind of work?
What led me to this is very personal. So I grew up in an evangelical, conservative, Southern Republican home, and that was very much my identity going into college. And then, like many people in college, I became more liberal, more of a Democrat. And then in recent years, I've become frustrated also with some of the discourse on the left and found that some of the challenges that I had with my upbringing had analogous issues on the left, where we're finding that the conversations are becoming a bit dogmatic and that there was a shift from being open and curious to maybe being more judgmental. And so I'm someone who holds a lot of relationships and has a lot of love for family members and friends who are on the left and on the right side of the spectrum, and a lot of people who are disoriented and don't have a political home, and would love to see less of that division and more common ground being built to solve problems that affect us all. So that's what drew me into the work. And I've been leading the research for More in Common since its beginning. And as Bob read out earlier, my background is in public opinion research for marketing purposes for political candidates. And now, most recently, over the last handful of years, to understand social phenomena like polarization and attitudes towards democracy and trust and other big thematic questions that are relevant to our work of trying to build stable, resilient, healthy societies in the countries that we live in so that they can be a force for good and so that our democracy and our societies can function in a way that benefits us all.
Can you say a little bit, Stephen, about how that organization came about? How did folks hook up to actually form that group, More in Common?
So More in Common's story begins with a tragedy, and that's that in 2016, a member of parliament, you may remember, her name was Jo Cox, was killed by one of her constituents. And she was killed because of her support for helping Syrian refugees, killed by somebody who was a British nationalist. We could argue he's a white supremacist. And he shot and stabbed to death Jo Cox, who was a friend of our co-founders. And in the wake of her death, which was a historic, unprecedented event in the UK, a lot of people were asking questions. How has our society become so divided that a politician would get murdered for her views? And so that was the moment. It was a very major national moment in the UK of this tragic event, and the outpouring of support and the questions that followed from that event led several of her friends and family members to put together this organization. And initially, the organization was focused on questions of immigration and refugees, the dominant question of 2015, 2016 in Europe and the UK because of the migrant crisis of migrants coming from North Africa and especially from Syria, the Middle East, and Afghanistan. And dealing with that was top of mind. And so our initial work was studying that. What's the psychology of the populations of Europe and the UK in terms of the complexity and nuance around their feelings towards refugees, where we found that overwhelmingly people were empathetic towards those who were fleeing from war and fleeing from civil violence and wanted to help those in most need. And then we also found that a lot of people had concerns about security, about costs, about integration, about mismatch of cultures. So explaining all of that was the first chapter of More in Common. And we found that there is often a group we refer to as the conflicted middle that we're wrestling with these tensions between empathy and concrete concerns. And we advised groups such as the UN Refugee Agency, UNHCR, on how to speak to those middle groups and how to navigate all of this relevant psychology of that moment. So just to conclude, that's how we began our work. And what we found in 2017, 2018, when we did our first research in the United States, was that really the questions of how countries were divided around immigration and refugees weren't isolated to the issues of immigration and refugees, but rather there was a broader landscape of conflict that was emerging between groups of people who were discontent and frustrated with the elite, who felt overlooked, who felt that their national identity was being overly criticized, and who were concerned about change in their culture, especially change from migration, and that there was a clear, more progressive, urban, educated, liberal cohort as well in most countries. And so what we did after that, starting in 2017, 2018, was try to draw a comprehensive, holistic map of the landscape of our divisions as a society, where we created categories of the different groups within society and where they fit on the left to right axis, where they fit in terms of their political engagement, how they feel towards each other, and what their views are on the major issues of our time. And it's creating these maps of our society, our segmentation studies, that has become sort of the central pillar of our work, and that we have been able to put together now in the UK, France, Germany, and the United States, together with our academic partners.
And it looks like, if one looks at the More in Common website, that you can find a number of reports. I see three major reports that have been done since 2018. One is called Hidden Tribes, another is called The Perception Gap, and the third is American Fabric, all of which you've co-authored. Can you take us through some of the highlights of the findings from the research that was done on this reports?
Sure. So let's go in chronological order. So Hidden Tribes, we wrote in, released rather, in October of 2018. And this was really our foundational study. It's very broad in subject matter. We're looking at, how are we divided as Americans? And that was a large study. We conducted that among 8,000 Americans. So 8,000 people completed our survey. And then we conducted about 60 in-depth interviews and focus group conversations and so on in order to put together this long form report. And what we found is that to understand America's divisions, you really can't look at it in a binary way. Republican versus Democrat is too messy and simplistic of an analysis. We found that there were seven groups. We called them the hidden tribes. And so these seven groups range in size: progressive activists, traditional liberals, passive liberals, politically disengaged, moderates, traditional conservatives, and devoted conservatives. So seven different groups. And what we found is that when you stop looking at it through Republican, Democrat, and you look at it with this broader seven more granular groups, you can see that so much of the political conflict in the United States is characterized by just three of those seven groups. The progressive activists on the left, and then the devoted and traditional conservatives on the right, are what we call the wings. And those are the groups that are most politically engaged. They have the most internal commonality in perspective. They're the ones that are most hostile towards the opposite side. And then you have this group in the middle that we refer to as the exhausted majority. And the exhausted majority encompasses four of those groups, the ones that I didn't mention as being part of the wings. So that's the traditional liberals, the passive liberals, politically disengaged, and the moderates. And that group is one that I think many people really could relate to. And we found, after we released that report, that everyone was interviewing us and saying, I feel as if I am a member of the exhausted majority. And what they were saying was, I feel that neither end of the political spectrum really captures how I feel. I find that I'm often more ideologically flexible, more open to different ideas than some are on the extreme ends, that I don't feel that the political discourse and the news media really reflects my viewpoints, and that I'm fatigued by the political conflict in the country and want to see something new, want to see something more productive. And so that was one of our major findings, was the exhausted majority. The other major finding we found that got a lot of coverage in the news, and you know, the Hidden Tribe study got a lot of media attention there. We've had about 1,000 news articles that reference it, including front page of the New York Times in 2019. And one of the findings that got the most attention was on political correctness, where we found that 80% of Americans said that political correctness is a problem, and that that represents a majority of Black and Hispanic and young and women that doesn't have a strong relationship to demographics. It had a strong relationship to whether you were a progressive or not. And that finding pairs with also finding that a majority of Americans find that hate speech is a problem in our society. And so there's this tension between people recognizing that racism is a problem, is another major finding we found. That was consensus on that, and consensus that hate speech is a problem, but also finding that those on the left who are seeking to address that problem by having different standards of what's acceptable to speak and to think and to say and what ideas should be allowed to have a voice in society, that people take issue with that as well. And so there's this complexity here of concern about extreme right and concern about a sort of policing behavior from the left. And that that tension was something which got a lot of traction and led to a lot of discussion in the media. So that's Hidden Tribes.
Let me ask one question about the Hidden Tribes. I've got this fantastic, colorful graphic from your website that shows actually seven groups, and then you've lumped three of those groups, the progressive activists on the left and the traditional conservatives and devoted conservatives, which are the two most right-wing of the group, and call those the wings. Mm-hmm. And then you have four groups in between, I guess. What I wondered is, without getting too much into the statistical weeds, how did those groups fall out of your responses from questions that you asked in surveys?
Thank you for asking that. It's super relevant. The method that we used was a type of cluster analysis. And cluster analysis is a common method that's been used, for instance, by Pew since the 1980s to create segmentation studies. And the cluster analysis, what it does is it takes your input variables, the things that you want to understand better, and then it identifies groups within the patterns of people's responses to those questions. And so we took two major types of input variables. One was around political behavior. So do you go to protests? Do you vote in local elections? Do you give money to political candidates? And then the other was on the psychology of politics. And so we're not asking about specific issues. Do you support Trump? How do you feel about a border wall? We asked about the broader questions of people's attitudes towards parenting, their what's called moral foundations, which is a theory developed by Jonathan Haidt. We asked about their identity. And so we're drawing on their psychology and drawing on their behavior to then find patterns of how people are distributed across their psychology and their behavior to end up being sorted into one of those seven groups that you read out there.
Go ahead and fill in the gap with the perception gap and American fabric.
Okay, so the perception gap followed from Hidden Tribes. In 2019, we wrote a report called The Perception Gap. And in the academic vernacular, the subjects we're exploring there are meta perceptions and false polarization. And so what that means is we're asking people to explain the psychology of their political opponents. And so that's what's the meta perception part of it is, what do you think others think? And then the false polarization is a phenomenon of people believing that we're more divided than there is evidence to show. And so what the perception gap did was we said, we gave people effectively a quiz. We said, are you a Republican, independent, or Democrat? And so if people said they're a Republican, we gave them a battery of questions. We said, what percent of Democrats do you think believe X? What percent of Democrats do you think believe Y? And we had them make estimates and vice versa. So Democrats answered about Republicans and so on. And the independents answered about both Republicans and Democrats. And then we asked these respondents to answer the questions that their political opponents were making estimates about. So what we could then compare is what Democrats think Republicans think versus what Republicans report to us that they actually think, and vice versa. And so it's a bit complicated to sort of lay out the methodology, but what we found in simple terms is that Republicans and Democrats aren't very good at explaining what the other thinks in terms of questions around race or immigration or gun rights. What we found is that the more politically engaged you are, the more intense of a Republican or the more strong of a Democrat you are, the worse you are at estimating how your political opponents think. And in particular, we found that people overestimated how extreme their political opponents' views are. And this was something which was very interesting to us because we found that the people who watch the most political news or read the most political news were actually less informed than the people who didn't watch political news, right? And we found that there wasn't a relationship with education. So it wasn't a matter of people becoming less ignorant through more education. More educated people were often just as bad or worse than less educated people at predicting their political opponent's views. And so what it shows is that the people who are most politically engaged tend to work with something of a caricature of their political opponents. And the people who are less political, who walk around not thinking about politics very much, have a more sensible, grounded understanding of how we tend to be more similar than we think. And we tend not to have as extreme of views on average as people who are more politically engaged tend to guess.
And I put that down to the rage machines.
Indeed, yes. And then finally, we have the American Fabric Project, which is the most recent of the three projects here. And this is one which concluded with a report in 2020. And what we were exploring there was so much of the conflict in the United States seems to be around American identity, whether it's critical race theory or whether it's about statues and history. And so what we wanted to understand is, how do people feel about their American identity? How do they feel about American history? How divided are we? And we found that, again, there's a bit of a distinction between progressives and non-progressives in the country with regards to how they feel about being an American themselves. Most people say that they're grateful to be American and that they're proud to be American. We're talking 70, 80% of people. That's less true for progressives. And we find that most people can acknowledge that America has made mistakes, it has a troubled past, that its legacy on slavery and its legacy of treatment of Native peoples is something that is an issue, is a problem. And that's less true of among our devoted conservatives who have a harder time acknowledging those problems. And instead, we find that there is a common core of Americans who are willing to have a nuanced view of American history and of America in the present day that acknowledges its flaws together with its strengths, and that people also have a common view of what it is to be a good American, which is to participate in voting, to follow the news, and a few other items that are more civically oriented like that. And so we see that there could be some potential for diffusing conflict around American identity by leaning into the nuance rather than by forcing a narrative of either the United States as this flawless country of excellence or as a country born in evil and characterized forever by evil. Most Americans reject both of those as simplistic.
Let's go into a little more detail about the perception gap phenomenon. And before we do that, Stephen, let me see if I kind of have the overview of the arc that More in Common is moving in, that being the first thing to look at the polarization and get details through research on just what groups are out there based on maybe their worldviews, their belief system, the whole constellation that would help take individuals and have them fall out into groups. And you've identified those groups, and we've talked about the seven groups and the wings and the middle. And that's the starting point. And then after that is to get some detail on the amount of accuracy there is in the way those different groups perceive each other's beliefs. And then the third part of that arc, as you just described, is then where can we find the common ground and what can we do to work for it? Is that a good kind of summary of what More in Common is all about?
I think that's a good summary. Yeah, definitely.
Okay, well, let's get into a little bit more detail about the perception gap phenomenon and what listeners can do with that information. In other words, if there is indeed a perception gap, what does that mean to individuals who are trying to have conversations with other people in their family or making assumptions about what some of the people on the other side are thinking about?
I think it has a couple types of implications for that. So the first is that we should be wary of projecting into other people's minds what beliefs they have. And I don't know if this is something which you two can relate to. Personally, it's something which happens in our family, is that when we stop having regular conversations about politics, we tend to imagine that those who disagree with us have the most extreme views and agree with all of the competing perspective, rather than seeing where there's commonality and moderation. And so one thing that I think is a recommendation coming out of the perception gap, right? This idea that we tend to, as especially the most politically engaged people, tend to overstate and exaggerate how extreme people from the opposite party are, is to try and keep conversations open and regular with people in your lives who are across the political spectrum so that we don't misconstrue and overestimate how different we are from others. This is where it's fascinating that those who are politically disengaged, and this is a group we identify as having representing about a quarter of Americans, 26% of Americans who don't follow the news very regularly, are less likely to vote, et cetera, they actually have a pretty good read on the average Democrat and the average Republican because they're in conversations with people of all different types and because they get less of their information from what you call the rage machine, Bob, that is partisan news sources. So that's one implication and finding coming out of the perception gap phenomenon. And the other, I think, is what we could refer to as our news diet. You know, it used to be in the 20th century, in the 1960s, 70s, and even later with the few major news networks that existed and the few major papers and local papers, that the process of calibrating your political information was done by editorial teams at the news companies who wanted to maintain a bipartisan audience and not offend them and not be unfair to them because their business model was sustained and their business practices were based on principles of objectivity and nonpartisanship. But as we've seen news media proliferate, the emergence of cable news, and as social media has allowed for everyone to have their own political voice and their own political constituency, we see that the news media are increasingly catering to what the perspective that their base already holds, and then through a process of reinforcement and confirmation bias, providing every day or with every news story a confirmation of that pre-existing belief rather than challenging it with more objective news. And so the response to that is to try and have your own balanced news diet by reading broadly, watching broadly, and listening to voices that you disagree with to see where you might be missing parts of the picture.
Exactly. That is what I was thinking. The first part does resonate with me because I do have someone in my family who has that distorted idea, probably from either Rogan or right-wing news sources. And brings that up when we're in conversation that, oh, yeah, well, the liberals want to do this. You know, this was what they're all about. And I do reinforce that with that person as to, well, there are some liberals that do that. But do you think that's the majority of liberals? So we're going to talk in a moment. I'm going to ask you a question about what people can get from the various websites that More in Common offers. But I do want to mention first that we are talking to Stephen Hawkins. He's the director of research at More in Common about the work that the organization is doing to more deeply understand political tribalism, including those differences between what people in one polarized group think they know about the beliefs of those in another group and what that other group's beliefs actually are. And that's a concept that we've been calling the perception gap. And we're also talking about and going to talk about more what we can do to improve our communication with people who believe differently than we do. And when I look at the projects from More in Common, I see at least three different websites, or maybe more, but there are three different websites that seem to be linked with More in Common. One is called Hidden Tribes. The other is called The Perception Gap. And the third is called Democracy for President. So can you describe those sites and how they fit into the mission of More in Common and what those sites actually offer to users?
Of course. So all of those three websites relate to the work that we've done in the United States. And of course, we do work in Europe as well. And the reason we've created those websites is because there's something important about knowing how you fit within the story, right? We are not just observing the United States from a distance, but we are members of this community, and we have our own political views and biases and preferences. And so what each of those websites allows for is You can, of course, go and read about our findings from that study, and you can download the report. But there's also an interactive component. So with the Hidden Tribes website, which you can go to at hiddentribes.us, you can take the quiz. And the quiz is the typology instrument that we provided to the public. So you can answer the questions, and then it will tell you which of the seven tribes you is the best fit for your answers. And you can read about that profile and discover if you're a traditional liberal or if you're a traditional conservative or something else. And that's what the Hidden Tribes website offers. With the Perception Gap website, you can see how good you are at predicting what your political counterparts think on a range of relevant issues. So for instance, if you're a Democrat, you can go to the website and make your guesses about how Republicans would likely answer questions around race, around immigration, and so on, and see how close or far off you are relative to other Democrats and how close you are to understanding how Republicans think. And then Democracy for President is an interactive website with a lot of resources to help understand the conversation around election integrity, which was most relevant in the fall of 2020 with the presidential election, but remains relevant today because of the ongoing conversations around the disputed 2020 election result. The three websites work together to advance More in Common's mission in that what we are trying to do is foster a high level of social cohesion. That is, we want societies that are able to use discourse to solve problems. And if we lose discourse as an instrument for cooperating and working together, we don't have much else that we can use. As some say, the only alternative to dialogue is violence. And so we are keen to keep dialogue healthy and functioning. And we're, of course, I think it's crucial to have strong, healthy democratic institutions and fair elections to make sure that people's voices are heard and that the mechanism that we have for cooperating together and solving problems, which is democratic governance, that we continue to believe in those institutions and continue to respect their outcomes. And so those are the three websites, and would encourage you to visit them and learn more about yourself and more about the country.
And the Hidden Tribes, I would encourage people to start off with that website. It's just hiddentribes.us, one word, no spaces, hiddentribes.us. And when I did that, I did take the quiz. I came out as a progressive activist, but I really consider myself more of a traditional liberal. So I think there's some nuances there, at least for me, when I went through and answered the questions, between values and methods. I would consider myself being very consistent with liberal values in general, overall values, but I disagree with some of the methods on the left that are used. So I think it's good to take that quiz, and because one of the things that it does is to get you thinking about the difference between what people will advocate needs to be done versus what the values really are. And so all of that is sort of some of the nuances and depth that I think you'll find when you really dig into these. And I do encourage listeners to dig into everything that Hidden Tribes has done. As you can probably get from our conversation so far, there is a lot of information. It's based on research, and these reports are very comprehensive and worth reading. The other thing that I want to comment on is when I took the quiz on the perception gap, I came out with zero perception gap, but I think it was because I overestimated and underestimated at about the same way. In other words, it kind of canceled it out. You know what I mean? When I really looked at my scores there, because the way it's done is to take the average. All the gaps. I was wondering why the algorithm that is behind the scoring of that didn't do it kind of like you score a variance. You know, you take the, you square it and then add the results and then take the square root.
Yeah, that would have been another way for us to look at the distance on average, the average distance from the true value that we're making the comparison. I take your point. I think what we wanted to do with our analysis, though, was have directionality where we could show where people were overestimating how much they disagreed versus underestimating how much they disagreed. So we needed directionality in addition to scale. And so having that negative and positive sign allowed us to do that throughout our analysis. But you're right that there's another feature of the estimate, which is the scale. And somebody in theory could have very off numbers in both directions and then get a low value. But we looked into those sorts of patterns when we were conducting the initial analysis to make sure that we weren't in any way misinterpreting what the findings showed. And we have the error bars on those estimates as well at the group level, so you can see the range of outcomes people got.
Yeah, there's very good graphics. The graphics really help.
And that's the credit there goes to my colleague, Dr. Daniel Yudkin, currently based at the University of Pennsylvania, PhD in social psychology, and he led that report.
Earlier, we talked about, you know, the need for dialogue, especially between people of different ideologies, different tribes. Kind of digging into that, and of course, beyond just dialogue, you know, what can some of our listeners do to actively in their life to foster cooperation in these shared challenges? We're all in this proverbial boat together. And I'm sure a number of our listening audience wants to know how they fit into this puzzle and how they can improve the situation that we're all in.
It's a great question. And, you know, a moment ago, I was talking about news information and how that relates to the challenges of getting an undistorted, accurate picture of society. And that's about changing your behavior to doing something new. But there's something old that we used to do more in the United States. And that was we used to belong to more communities and church attendance, PTAs, sports leagues, bowling leagues, civic organizations, Kiwanis clubs, chambers of commerce at local level. And these sorts of intermediary institutions that are not private sector, they're not part of the government, they're just a way for people to spend time together around a common interest or a common cause. They tend to have a lot of value, not because of what they do politically, but in some ways it's because of what they don't do politically. What they don't do politically is exacerbate partisan divisions. And what they do achieve is they allow people to mix with a diversity of people of maybe income groups and demographic differences, and political views. And the point of those institutions is rarely anything directly political, which means that you interact with people who are different from you in a way that might give you more understanding of people who are different from you in a context that doesn't have politics hanging over it and as its driving purpose, but it's instead about something that's less controversial. And so one recommendation from us is join a community. Don't let your communities fizzle out as COVID continues to keep people isolated and alienated, because those groups, which may be just about getting parents together or about a common sport, help us to have a good social dialogue going about things which aren't political, but that allow us to interact with people of different political backgrounds. And the decline of those institutions is coinciding with the phenomenon that we call stacking of identities in the United States, where we see that the people who are more liberal or more conservative increasingly live in different areas, and that institutions and churches and other groups are oftentimes now coinciding with political identities. And so your church, your sports league, and your other organizations might becoming more political over time, and the area you live might be more politically homogenous. Those are trends that we are worried about, and we can work against them by trying to stay more engaged in our communities and not leave clubs that we used to belong to. And so that's one of the things I think, Julia, that we can do, which is fun and isn't about politics and yet has some social value. Does that make sense?
Oh, yeah, I think that's excellent advice, you know, especially resonates with us. This show was born at a community radio station, which is very much, I think, the core of that. If I could ask kind of a more challenging question, how do we respond when these communities become injected with politics and polarization?
Well, I think it depends a little bit on what the community is for. In some cases, that might be appropriate. You know, if you're dealing with a parent-teacher conference or parent-teacher association, rather, that needs to take on some issue which does have a political nature to it, then that's appropriate. But if the purpose of the organization is softball, it's not. And I think preserving apolitical spaces by drawing attention to what the goal is of the organization is something which can help mitigate that slide towards more political division and more political sorting. And that's something which I think we will need to actively pursue, is keeping the boundaries of politics from entering into every domain. And because there, as tensions grow, and as people's concerns about the country grow, the politicization of more organizations, institutions is likely to be an increasing symptom of that. And having a place of respite from politics and having a place of community that cuts across political categories is something that's worth fighting for. And so I would encourage people to resist having their civic community sports organizations take on a political tenor for that reason.
I think it's excellent advice.
This reminds me of a couple of conversations we have had with other guests, Jonathan Rauch being one of them, is that if we're talking about online communities, that one of the keys seems to be to not just have complete freedom, a completely open community, but to have some guidelines to follow and some rules kind of set out at the start. And to keep the dialogue civil, to keep it from being hijacked by trolls and that sort of thing. And that balance between freedom and ability to make rules from the bottom up versus rules and guidelines set top down at the start, I think is key to some of this that we're seeing. Maybe you can fill in a little bit, because another thing I saw on the website was some information that had to do with core values. And that got into sort of some of the work, it sounded, that reminded me of Jonathan Haidt. Can you talk a little bit about that, the core beliefs and the information that sort of has to do with the work of Haidt?
Yeah, certainly. So the core beliefs category of variables that you're referring to there is it's a group of variables that capture people's worldview. How do they feel about other people? How do they feel about human nature? What are their key moral values? And so among the most important subset of that group is are the moral foundations. And the moral foundations include authority, fairness, purity, and a few others. And what these values refer to are, in some ways, you can think of it as kind of our moral palette. So just as you have the capacity to sense different things, and you might appreciate different tastes to a different degree based on your culture, based on what you're most familiar with, based on what you've been taught to like more and what you're accustomed to, moral foundations theory tries to do something similar. This is Jonathan Haidt's work in showing the degree to which people vary in their values. So one of the most important ones we've found is loyalty, and so, or sometimes referred to as in-group. So to what degree do you feel that you have an obligation to help your family, even if it means helping your family because they've broken the rules and now they're in a difficult spot? But you have an obligation to help them because they're a member of your family. To what extent Do you feel that you should care more about people who are from your country than for people who are in a bad situation outside of your country? So loyalty is one that matters a great deal. Fairness and care are two that tend to be the most prominent among people who are on the left side of the spectrum. And these are about reducing suffering, and these are about caring about others and from a place of empathy and compassion and wanting there to be justice. And we see that a lot in the language on the left is around those values. And conservatives tend to have, they tend to care about care and fairness, but they also care about these more groupish values. As I was saying, loyalty is one. The other is authority, where they care a great deal about the preservation of and respect for the group's authority figures, whereas left historically has more of a anti-authority individual empowerment ethos. And this gets complicated because it depends on whether the authority figure has credibility, and there's now a rejection of a lot of cultural authority by the right. But this is it's one of the features of conservatives that the social literature and academia has borne out over and over, is this respect for authority. And then lastly, there's this moral foundation of purity. And this is an important one because it relates to what people find disgusting in society and in everyday life and how repelled they are by it. And so on the right, you have a stronger sense of disgust at sexual impropriety. And on the left, you have less of that sense, and you have more of an appreciation for diversity and individual choices. And so these moral foundations give us a bit of a language to talk about how many of our debates are characterized from one perspective only, and they don't see the underlying value that your counterpart is trying to preserve. They just see it as something which is bad or as something which is rejecting the value they care about. So we found that by using moral foundations theory in our segmentation model, we're able to have a more nuanced and rich understanding of the psychological profile of people across the spectrum.
The other thing that comes to my mind, I think, that is relevant to what we've been talking about is on your websites, and I think you've alluded to that a little bit, is one of the missions of More in Common is to take the information that comes out of the research and to help bring Americans together. And it seems like one of the approaches is to help Americans in all these groups, and including the extreme parts of the groups, to come to some agreement on what it means to be an American. Mm-hmm. Am I right about that?
Yes. Well, the working hypothesis behind that is that we believe that a superordinate identity is one means of addressing conflict between subordinated identities. And to put that in more accessible language, when you're fighting, if you can appeal to a group that both sides of the fight also belong to, and the values and history and future of that group, that can be one way of mitigating the conflict from escalating. And so I think that one of the challenges in the United States right now is that our culture is in conflict, and we have a strong sense of, especially steered from the left, a strong sense of responsibility for addressing the injustices that have characterized the United States for most of its history and maybe till the present day. And that emphasis on that responsibility and empathy towards the people who have been most mistreated, by American history is a very active, maybe dominant impulse in the conversation around what it is to be American and around the United States and its character. And on the right, I think you have a bit of a simplistic sense of the United States as often, you know, just being about heroism and success and brilliance and conquest of science and athletic prowess and so on. And most Americans find, you know, just seeing one through one lens or the other as being insufficient and lacking in nuance. And so our hope is that a better conversation about American identity and a strong sense that I belong to America, I am an American, can be imbued, and that it can be, being American can be imbued with 21st century values that characterize what we want the future to be like, can be a way of mending divisions, building excitement around a common vision for the future, and reducing the degree to which we're focused on Republican, Democrat, left, right, progressive, conservative, and more emphasis on a shared agenda and a shared vision. But this is very hard. This is extremely challenging work. And if I can just continue here for a second, Bob, I think, you know, the work we did in 2017, 2018 to Hidden Tribes was focused on those differences in values. And the differences in values means you can have two people looking at the same situation and come to different conclusions, not based on the facts, but based on what they think is more important among the facts. And sadly, what we've seen in the United States in the last couple of years is more of a divergence, not in values only, but in reality. There's a divergence in shared reality and a fracturing of our understanding of the country around two main issues in particular: the COVID-19 protocols and vaccines, which have become very divisive and correlate very closely with Republican-Democrat viewpoints, with Republicans being the most skeptical, Democrats being the most embracing. And of course, around the 2020 election, where Donald Trump, I think, in my view, completely unfairly has characterized the election as being fraudulent. And that view has become pervasive among Republican rank and file voters, and the January 6th insurrection was deemed by the Republican Party to be legitimate political discourse in the last week. And so you're seeing that we're now operating not just with competing values — you care more about loyalty, I care more about empathy — but now we're competing along lines of fractured realities. You think Joe Biden is the president. I think Donald Trump should have been the president and was cheated out of an election. And I think your vaccine is poisonous. And so this is complicating and compounding the challenges that we're facing. And while a shared American identity can be one antidote to that, it's a very precarious situation that we're in, with the basic questions of our society having such strong and competing answers along political lines.
I'm in total agreement that that shared identity idea is a valuable approach to attempt. And I'm also in agreement that it's very difficult. I was telling Julia before we started the interview, and this dates me in terms of my age, but I remember, and it was back in the 50s, on TV and radio, a little jingle going, and it went like this. It says, "What makes a good American? What do you have to be? Am I a good American? Let's take a look and see." And then it would go on and on about what it meant to be a good American. You know, I don't know if you're going to go back to that approach or what, but I'm going to be very interested in watching more in common to see how you work towards that shared identity, because I think that is key.
Yes. And, you know, one of the things we learn from social science about what allows for strong in-group identity, it's that an outside group, an out-group or an external threat, often is what allows people to see how they're connected to other people. And during the 1950s, 60s, when that jingle would have been playing, there was that external threat in the form of the Soviet Union that was atheistic and communist, and that was a military threat to the United States. And to a degree, I mean, this might have been especially true of white Americans and less true of non-white Americans, I think that served as some kind of safeguard against the divisions sprawling further and further towards conflict, because there was this sense that, well, at least you're not a Soviet communist, atheist, Stalinist, as would have been the case in the 1940s and so on. So we lack that external threat today. You might think it could be climate change, could be artificial intelligence, maybe China. But I think relative to the Cold War era, it's a weaker sense of a shared conflict or an outgroup. And so the question is, can we find a constructive way of building that sense of in-group that doesn't rely on the fear and the threat from an external source? And the last point on that is we did see some glimmers of that in the early months of the response to COVID in 2020, with Republicans and Democrats working together on initial packages. And Americans, according to our polling in the spring, late spring of 2020, were feeling a stronger sense of togetherness and shared purpose. Things weren't perfect. Things weren't even necessarily good, but there was a sense that there's a little bit more that's in common here as we try and address this shared threat. And that trust and that shared sense of purpose fizzled out very quickly in the wake of the George Floyd protests, which divided the country, and then the subsequent 2020 election.
Great summary. Julia, any last minute thoughts?
No, I'm still mulling this over and trying to figure out how we're all going to come together after this.
Well, Stephen Hawkins, I want to thank you very much for being with us to share your experience and the work that is being done by More in Common. So on our Facebook page, we're going to post a link to More in Common and the websites, one of them being hiddentribes.us, all one word, another being perceptiongap.us, all one word, and democracyforpresident.com. Are there any other links that you'd like us to post, Stephen?
Well, if you just go to moreincommon.com, then you can follow all of our research. We're going to be releasing reports in the coming weeks, which could be of interest to your viewers and listeners.
Okay, great. And to our listeners, a big thanks for listening. And to you, Julia, thank you very much.
Thank you both.
Thank you, Stephen. And Bob, until next time, keep thinking
clearly.